This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Nicholas Papandreou is the third-generation son of one of the first families of Greece. His grandfather, George Papandreou, was a liberal politician who served as prime minister in the early 60s. At the beginning of his career, Nicholas's father, Andreas, was deputy minister in George Papandreou's administration. As a child in Greece, Nicholas witnessed the turbulent political upheavals that marked his family's time in office. The Papandreou government was dismissed by King Constantine in 1965. After a right-wing military coup in 1967, Andreas Papandreou was imprisoned for 8 months and lived in exile until 74, when the military dictatorship ended. Andreas went on to serve two separate terms as prime minister, from 81 to 89, then again from 93 to 96. In his new novel, A Crowded Heart, Nicholas Papandreou tells the story of a young boy named Alex, whose family, like his own, leaves America for Greece, where his father is preparing to become the next prime minister, and is caught up in a wave of revolution, military dictatorship, and finally, exile. Terry Gross spoke with Nicholas Papandreou recently. She asked him to read a passage from his new novel. The passage is based on what happened the night his father was arrested.
In April 1967, the night of the coup, a fanatic came to arrest my father. At the age of 9, I had an irrepressible need to imitate sounds, the putt-putt of a caiki, the strangled cry of a donkey, the alarm clock and the sizzle of coffee spilling over the briki. I thought he was a thief, and I imitated the siren of a police car to scare him. He was not deterred. When he entered my bedroom, he looked at me with his invincible gaze. I felt that if I got too close to him, I would be sucked into an empty space. He must be alive, because I still see him in my dreams. That night weakened our family's centrifugal gravity, loosened the orbits. My sister turned inward and grew less talkative, while my older brother blamed himself for his father's arrest and hurled himself into politics like a Minoan dancer. My youngest brother barricaded himself behind a deceptive smile, and I had recurring dreams of being strangled by the fanatic officer. As for my parents, in the ensuing years, they exhausted their love for the ultimate good and sacrificed it for the all-absorbing struggle of politics. Politics is an enemy to family, an opposing force. At some point, love, no matter how strong, hides and cowers in the corner, while politics, hot, naked, and sweating, moves in like a minotaur.
That was Nicholas Papandreou reading from his new novel, A Crowded Heart. You moved to Greece in around 64. When you got to Greece, did you get an immediately different sense of your father? You had seen him as the Berkeley professor when he was living in exile in the United States. And now in Greece, he was the political hero. Did he seem like a different man to you?
Only in the sense that I didn't see very much of him. In Berkeley, I saw quite a bit of him. We even had picnics on Saturday. Once we arrived in Greece, all those family gatherings disappeared. And he was out late at night and came and left very early in the morning, so basically, he disappeared from the home.
What did he represent in Greek politics when he returned?
I think he represented youth, a new voice, and perhaps paradoxically, an American voice of sort of the liberal dream about democracy, equality, and a struggle for the underdog. And that sort of language, coming straight out of Berkeley of the early 60s in Greece, was very explosive.
And what did the king of the time, King Constantine, represent?
King Constantine represented the past, really, an old force and foreign control, since the king in Greece was imposed in 1860s by Bavaria, basically. So it represented everything foreign.
In your new novel, there's a lot of scenes of the boy watching his father speak before a huge and enthusiastic crowd. Were you in front of a lot of crowds as a boy? Did you start to understand the different personalities that crowds can have?
That's a very good question. And it's interesting that you yourself have noticed that. Yes, crowds have different personalities. And the crowds of that time were, for me, full of passion, and perhaps because I'm older, seemed sort of dreamlike in their quest for a vision. But I was afraid even from then what would happen if the crowd, instead of shouting our last name in support, would shout it in anger. So I did, I think, already have a premonition of a future which might be much less optimistic and favorable to our family in Greece.
Let's get back to the night of the military coup. The coup was, I believe, in part a response to your father's popularity. What was the motivation behind the coup the way you understand it now as an adult?
Well, there was an effort to change the existing order, which meant that the king should have less power, and basically to come out of a civil war and a McCarthyite era where anybody center and left of center was under the gun. And through the democratic process, it seemed quite clear that both Papandreous, meaning my grandfather and father, were going to come to power, and they came to power. And then they were running again for elections. And using the fear of communism, which, strangely enough, was something neither of those two people supported, but they were certainly left of center, a group of military men that were steeped in the 30s and in the Civil War and in that McCarthyite era took over the country thinking they were protecting the country from some evil force. And I think, looking back, that those people who took over were very small in their views of the world and very blind to progress into a more democratic future. Sad cases, I would say, and they're serving out their time in prison now, and some of them had died in prison.
Who showed up at your house to arrest your father when the coup began?
Well, there was a person that I really knew was a fanatic officer who was shouting my father's name repetitively like a mantra so many times, and spit was coming out of his mouth, that I just knew it was sheer hate. They had chosen a person who probably thought my father was the devil incarnate. He was followed by soldiers who were less fanatic, but that man was enough to, as I write in the book, to create quite a few nightmares for my future.
Where was your father hiding?
He was hiding on the roof of a three-floor home, and when a gun was pointed at my older brother's head and he heard it, he jumped and...
When your father heard that the gun was pointed at your
brother's
head?
Right, he heard the officer say, "Tell us where your father is or I'll shoot." And at that point, my father wasn't willing to go through that process, of course, and sacrifice my older brother. He jumped, and the expression of satisfaction on the officer's face, because I happened to be there in that same area, was incredible. And the soldiers lifted their rifle butts and started beating him in front of us.
Beating your father?
Yeah, while he had, in the jump, he had landed on glass, so there was quite a bit of blood coming out of his legs where he had stepped and pierced his skin. So it's a strange thing to find your father, who is a image of power as you're growing up, so weak, to see him so vulnerable. It shifts your viewpoint quite quickly.
Were you crying when they dragged out your father?
No, something was wrenched out of me, though. I felt I couldn't help him. It was a strange situation. And I saw him in the truck, but I had this sense, I guess from being very young, that he was invincible still and that they wouldn't kill him. It turns out, historically, they had a big meeting that night to decide whether to execute him or not. And they decided not to.
Why not?
They said in one of the memoirs I read of one of these people who took over, they didn't want to turn him into a martyr. And once they had him in their control, they didn't really know what to do with him. So it was a chance circumstance that their own analysis of the situation said, don't execute this man.
What impact did that night have on your older brother, the one who had the gun to his head, the one to whom the fascists were saying,
"I'll shoot you.
Where's your father? I'll shoot you."
Well, I think it had a huge impact. I think he felt guilty that it was his fault that my father gave himself up. Strange as that might sound, but, you know, these things don't necessarily have a logical process. And I think that's why he went into politics. It was a way to make up for having supposedly allowed my father to be captured. And that was a way to make up for it.
What position does he hold now, your brother?
Now he's alternate minister of foreign affairs. It means sort of number two in the State Department, the equivalent over here. Very great belief in multiculturalism. Many of the ideas that are quite popular here in the States are some of the things that he talks about, and a great believer in continuing education and adult education.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Papandreou, and his father and grandfather were prime ministers of Greece, and he's written a new novel based on his own experiences as a boy in Greece called A Crowded Heart. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nicholas Papandreou. His father and his grandfather were prime ministers of Greece, and now Nicholas Papandreou has written a novel about what it was like to be a boy in Greece, and the novel is called A Crowded Heart. When your father was arrested the night of the military coup, were you afraid that your father was in for a long period, not only of arrest, but of torture?
Yes. Not instantly afraid, because I actually didn't know about the existence of torture at that age. I was about 9 years old. By one of those strange coincidences, I happened to be reading 1984 very shortly after that. And through that book and through a visitor who came to our house who had been tortured, I'd seen him before and after, I came to believe that the future of the world was going to be torturous for many people, and that my turn would soon be up as I got older. That adulthood perhaps meant being tortured if you really went out on a limb for your beliefs.
What was your boyhood understanding of what torture was?
I think it had to do sort of with that Orwellian idea that what's discovered is the thing that you're scared of most. And if you don't like spiders, they're going to put spiders on your face. If you don't like dentists, they're going to pull out your teeth. I had sort of a vague image. Probably you don't really want to hear much about that at that age, and you don't want to read any gory descriptions. And there weren't many books available on that topic as they are now. It wasn't something that was widely known. So I can't really recall all the images, but I carried them through my life, that something very painful, of course, and with people not respecting you at all. The way that I saw those soldiers and the officer showed disrespect to my father, to a bodyguard there, to my sister, and to many of the people in the family. They were sort of throwing everybody around and banging their heads on the walls.
When your father was arrested at the start of the military coup, there were around, I think, 6,000 other people who were arrested too. There must have been this tremendous sense of national fear and repression. What did that feel like to you as a child?
Well, what I was surprised was, having seen these huge crowds, to find them suddenly disappear from the streets. These crowds, as you said, that have their own personality,
mm-hmm.
no longer there. And that was strange for me. It really taught me that what you see is not necessarily what you get, that there's a lot of passion, but that does not necessarily translate into some sort of resistance. And when, of course, the state is so strong, and there is a history of a security state in Greece, so that one person is afraid of the other, a history of people going to the police and ratting on their neighbors during the McCarthyite era of the 50s, the streets were empty. That's what I remember. I remember going to school and people looking at me very strange, and suddenly the house was empty. People were no longer coming there. So yes, there was a change, a very felt change.
Were you worried that the police would come for you too?
Yes, I was. And they did, I can't say come for me particularly, but they had no problem in physically giving us a hard time and twisting our arms and looking for things in the house and threatening us even at our young age. The security people would come in on a weekly basis, supposedly looking for rebellious activity or guns or grenades or God knows what. In fact, at one point, they had planted some grenades and guns in our backyard, and thank God for our two little dogs, Blackie and Gilda, who sniffed out the weapons. We found them, got rid of them. The security people show up in the backyard. Somehow, they go to that very spot where it was hidden. They sort of kick around because they're not supposed to know where it is. They keep kicking on the dirt, try to dig a little deeper, and they find nothing. Small revenge.
How did your father get out of prison?
Well, President Johnson, actually, the historical record shows, said, "Let that son of a beep out of prison," and the message was heard over to Greece. And they told him, "Here's a passport and get out of here."
So you moved out of Greece with your family when your father was released?
That's right. We went to Paris just in time for May 68, a brief stop in Sweden for a year, and then my high school years were in Canada.
So you lived in those areas between 1968 and 1974.
That's right.
Then the military dictatorship ended.
In 74.
Your family moved back to Greece.
I stayed in the States and continued my college education here.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I didn't go back. In spite of the mythic quality of Greece, I stayed in the States and continued my undergraduate and graduate education, which took quite a few years. Served in the Greek military, as I'm a dual citizen, Greek and American, and have been between both countries for most of my life. Sort of justice was done.
I'm wondering if things got more emotionally complicated after your father was elected prime minister in 1981. I'm thinking, you know, before that, your father was such a kind of clear-cut image of the man who stood for democracy, who stood for free speech and more equity in life. After he got elected and he had to actually run the government, over the years there were financial scandals that were alleged to have happened. Late in his career, he left your mother for a much younger woman, and I think he became a much more ambiguous figure in Greek politics, as so many politicians end up becoming more ambiguous once they're actually in power.
Oh, well, you're probably pointing out a good point for many people who finally get into power after many years, but if I can speak a little bit metaphorically, maybe some of us know the poem by Cavafy called Ithaca, and he says it's not Ithaca that you want to get to necessarily, it's the trip that counts. And I think once you get to that pinnacle of where you've been striving, that whole energy and that whole belief and vision, it's not clear what you do with that. Getting there is very important in shaping the situation. Once you're in power, all those things you talk about, suddenly you have to implement, and that's not an easy thing to do. And it's not clear that once you have to work out if you're going to have to fix the potholes in such a town, if you're going to have to make new highways or build a hospital, that is quite important for any country, but it's not really a vision anymore, and it's not necessarily about justice, the actual implementation of programs. And that would be my explanation, that the trip is as important as the final destination.
You are you have dual citizenship. You're a citizen of the United States and of Greece. You're living, I believe, full-time in Greece now. Tell me why you've chosen to live in Greece.
That's a good question. As you get older, you feel that you need roots. And for someone like me who's been back and forth so much, I decided that I would be close to the family that had gone through so many things as we grew up together, and that was important to me. And a brief comparison, Greece is a place where you feel like you're quite alive. The life is good there. The United States is a place where you can be very creative. Maybe perhaps the quality of life every day and the pressures here are very high, and so you have to make a trade-off, and I think I decided to put the emphasis on living. And that might mean that some of my writing, yes, my writing might not be as good as it could be. If I was in this incredible country where people are writing and exploring and doing poetry bashes, and we have radio shows like yours, which you can listen to in the morning and perhaps get inspired by for the rest of the day. So, yes, I had to choose to live the experience rather than to write about it.
Your new novel, A Crowded Heart, is really a autobiographical, or at least a semi-autobiographical novel. What did you choose to write about your experiences as a boy in Greece from the novelistic perspective instead of writing a memoir?
Well, I don't think a memoir would be interesting to anybody. This book is structured in a way that each chapter is almost like a short story, complete in and of itself, which means it has to be fictional because life does not set itself out in complete chapters with small epiphanies at the ending of it, as Joyce wrote his Dubliners. I'd like to consider this book more in the tradition of a pure fictional world. It's just that the events are well known. And so because some of the historical events in the book are real and people know about them, they assume that much else of the book is real. But I think when I do write, if I ever write, a true autobiography will not look like this book, besides a few events. So most of the things in there are a fictional creation. And literature is a way of dealing with some serious experiences. So in that sense, the book is real, that the sentiment about the world, the love for people, the passion for people that comes through the book is true. Now the dialogues and the stories and many of the characters are invented.
When you're in Greece, you are a part of the very well-known and very important Papandreou family. Father and grandfather were both prime ministers of the country. When you're in the United States, you know, maybe some people will really know about your family. They'll recognize your name. But I think for most people,
Nobody
it's not going to mean that much, right?
Yes.
So does that bring a sense of relief to you sometimes?
Yes, a great relief. It's very nice. And sometimes I just say my name is Nick Pappas or Nick Knight, any name that comes to my head. And I have no problem going anywhere. And it's very nice. And, you know, I don't necessarily always want to have that responsibility that I have to act a certain way and represent a certain political spectrum. So, yes, it's a great liberating sense to be in the United States and to play basketball and listen to the radio show and read books and walk in the streets and have nobody recognize you.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nicholas Papandreou talking with Terry Gross. His new novel is A Crowded Heart. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.